These verses from the very end of the Gospel according to St. Matthew, in effect, Jesus' last words to his disciples. The 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them, and when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I've commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, to the close of the age." Well, Texas Tech starts its work again for the second semester this week. And, you know, Texas Tech University, as most organizations, including the church, sort of a laboratory for power and authority, you know. There's at least one email I get every week from someplace on high, some chief assistant to some assistant chief, or out of the provost's office, letting us know that we better do something, we better stop doing something else, or reminding us what we forgot, etc. Power. Authority. A little bit more intense, at least in our world, in our department this semester, we will be interviewing four people and hopefully deciding who will be our next department chair. We're going to have a new leader sometime this semester. And our record with old leaders is not great. I've been there 22 years. The person that is currently our department chair is the fifth one in my tenure. And at least in my experience, a batting average is about 60%. Three, including the current one, is decent, helpful, respectful, empowering, and all of that. Two, however, one seemed bent on wrecking my life as soon as he showed up, and the other seemed bent on wrecking everybody's life. So what's new under the sun, we're not sure, but there's a little bit of an edge to the start of this semester because we're about to have a new leader, a new source of power and authority, which makes it somewhat refreshing to hear again if Jesus said anything at all. He said this at the very end of his time with us. "I've got the power. I give it to you to make disciples." That's the purpose. It transcends all other power and authority. Well, how does that work specifically? I mean, he's got the power, but how does he empower us to make disciples? Well, at least in two or three ways, as I've been thinking about that, again, in light of pending new leadership in our department. We have been given the power to speak, maybe even the imperative to speak. The question is, what should we say? When should we say it? And to whom? Well, interestingly enough, there's a commandment on the use of words. Actually, there's a couple. There's the second one that says, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain." That's a use of words and actions. But the more relevant one for this discussion is, oddly, the one we don't think about very much. And it's the third of only three of the Ten Commandments that are actually laws that can be broken with punishment. There's killing and stealing, obviously. But the eighth commandment is, "You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor." It's about speaking. And in legal terms, that's called perjury. But as the commandment is interpreted, it's not just what you shouldn't do. You shouldn't lie about or in some way defame. But there's an imperative connected to it as well. Martin Luther wrote in his Small Catechism, which are directions to children on how to keep the commandments, "We should fear and love God so that we not only don't use words to hurt or lie or deceive, but speak well of our neighbors and explain their actions in the kindest way." Now, clearly the actions of others are open to interpretation, and we can or not explain their actions in the kindest way. Well, that's the imperative on how we use words to make disciples, explain actions kindly. It's also the letter of recommendation season around Texas Tech, and over the break I've had requests from two students to write letters for recommendation, and I've done two others for other reasons, and last year, because I had to put this on my annual report because I got an email about it, I wrote 40 letters of recommendation, which is about average for someone who does what I do. In other words, I've been asked to speak kindly about the work of other people. And sometimes it's a reach to do that. Other times, not so much. But it's the process, I think, that's a useful indicator of who's got the power. We all have the power to speak about or for, on behalf of, other people, their businesses, their way of life. We give recommendations to people all the time. And the power rests in our decision to empower others with words of kindness and respect, or even a positive spin and the benefit of the doubt. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, empowered by your gift of speech to empower others. So we have power in our words that we use, and I think power also in our words that we selectively choose not to use. Kind of an interesting thing happened over the last couple of months. A lot of people think that my major job at Texas Tech is teaching, and that's partially true, but more important than that, at least in terms of how we're evaluated, is research. What have you put out? What have you written? What have you published? And this is a long process that carries with it some levels of degradation. Sent out an article for review toward the end of December because I wanted credit for it for 2016, and it only took a week for the editor to send it back and say, we don't think we can send this out for review. We don't have the kind of reviewers that will give it the appropriate look. And I'm going, what? This is on a topic that you've already published three articles of ours, two of which have gotten national press. How can you not find reviewers for this? So I was puzzled about that. Especially so since an article we'd sent out toward the middle of last year got zinged back to us in September, not just with a rejection, but with one reviewer that, I'm not kidding, went on for 8 pages of single-spaced type, chapter and verse, line by line, telling us how terrible this article was. And I knew it had some problems, but this person went on and on about it. Well, after getting that second sort of curt, we're not even going to bother looking at this, I went for a workout because I was annoyed. And during that workout, I composed in my head a rejoinder email that you would not believe. I was, you know, I had had it with the whole process and everything else. And I got back and I cooled off and I went to write this thing and I thought, okay, what happens if you send this thing? Do they suddenly write back and say, oh, we made a terrible mistake. Send us an article again, we'll publish it as is. Not likely. All it would do would be to escalate the rhetoric, escalate the anger, and continue my own rather stressful response to what had just happened. So I decided to exercise my right to remain silent. I shut it down, not to escalate the rhetoric beyond what it already was. I'd already processed it. So I took a breath, went online for about a half hour, found the instructions from another journal, and just sent it someplace else. Silently. Sometimes the words we don't use have the benefit of stopping the rhetoric, subverting the anger, and moving us toward peace. Go and make disciples of all nations, because you have the power to keep silent. The power to speak, the power to keep silent. And finally, I think we have the power of perspective, putting things into a broader context. If you ever fly out of Lubbock to the west or to the northwest, you might consider sometime picking Southwest Airlines. And this is not a commercial because they're such a great airline. They're an airline that's great in ways and like all the rest of them. But when you fly to the west or to the northwest from Lubbock, you generally have to change planes in Las Vegas. And that's kind of fun. I mean, I'm not talking about the slot machines in the terminal. I'm talking about the flight path from Lubbock to Las Vegas. Right about the time the pilot says we're going to make our initial descent, if you're sitting on the co-pilot side of the plane and you look down, you see the Grand Canyon. That's where it is. And the Grand Canyon is one of those things that's endlessly hyped and actually lives up to it. If you go to the Grand Canyon on the ground and look over the rim, it's just stunning. It's just amazing. But more so from the air, where you see it in its broader context. You go, oh my God. I mean, literally, oh my God. A little bit of water and a whole lot of time. Who's got the power? You know? Oh, it's awesome. I feel something similar just standing at the seashore, and we do this every year on purpose. If you stand just at the edge of the sea with your feet in the surf, and you look at the horizon, You are seeing a view that has been exactly like that since when in the beginning God separated the lands and the waters. You know, you're seeing the same thing, this enduring sound and smell. And who's got the power? The one that put this here and has kept it here, looking just like this. The canyon, the seashore. And even the notion of energy at all. I mean, all power literally comes from the sun. And when you look at the sun, you're in effect looking at a time machine. Because when the light from the sun hits your eyes, that light left the sun, I looked this up, on average, 8 minutes and 20 seconds ago. You're seeing a delay. Now, that distance was not haphazard, because if that distance between the Earth and the sun was fractionally different further away, we would freeze. I mean, fractionally different. If it was fractionally different closer, we would be scorched. There is a very precise and uncommonly delicate relationship between sunlight and Earth life. Who's got the power? The power of perspective. Whoever becomes our new department chair isn't going to change the depth of the Grand Canyon very much. They're not going to alter the angle of the horizon. And they're not going to change the speed of light or the warmth of the sun to any great degree. So the power of perspective enables us to take a breath and go, you know what? Maybe there's more at work than just this moment, than just this email, than just this circumstance, which is at the heart of Jesus' last words. Must have been my first month or so of seminary in a preaching class, we were asked to just suddenly pick your favorite Bible verse and talk about it. And for some reason, this one came to my mind. And I didn't even know why it was my favorite Bible verse, and I don't remember what I said about it then. But I do know now, I think, why it lived in my heart as it suddenly came forward. When I was a kid, my dad and I used to play a little game. It's called Who's Got the Power? We wrestle back and forth, and at some point, I think when he wanted to end the game, he'd put me in a hammer lock, you know, and he'd crank it a little bit, and he'd go, who's got the power? And I'd be laughing, and I'd say, oh, I do, Daddy. And he'd crank it a little more and say, who's got the power? And I would say, I do again. He goes, you do. I'll take this arm and break it off and beat you over the head with it. I go, oh, you've got the power, Daddy. And that was the end of the game. Well, of course, it's insanely funny. It was my first lesson in irony and absurdity. Because of all things my dad might do with or to me, the absolute last and most impossible thing would be to break my arm off and beat me over the head with it. He would not do that, and I understood that, and I trusted and believed in that with all my heart. Because he was always there. Well, that's what Jesus says at the end of the day. I will be with you always. Now, in the other parts of the New Testament, before you get to that point, the writers have told us Jesus has said terrible things about what was going to happen if we didn't buck up. I'm going to break your arm and beat you over the head with it and send you to where men will weep and gnash their teeth. And I'm going, at the end of the day, I just don't buy it. Because you went to the cross for me and for everybody. You fed the people from the bounty of your love. It just isn't going to happen, because the promise at the end of the day transcends circumstance or our own behavior. Intriguing to me, he does not say, behold, I will stop all terrible things from happening. Or behold, I will make all things happen great. He does not say that. He only says, whether it's great or terrible, I will be with you. I will be with you always to the close of the age. And from all authority that's been given to me, when I am with you, you are empowered. You are empowered to speak, to keep silent, to gain perspective, and make disciples of all nations. And I'm with you, and it's enough. Amen.